Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Andela for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. It was on October the 1st, 1987, that the Johannesburg Stock Exchange would become one of the first major exchanges to move away from what we would know as open outcry trading, that is floor trading, towards the electronic trading environment that we find ourselves in today. This would begin the technological transformation of South Africa's capital markets and usher in a new era for the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. I'm Jim Mweha. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest out of the team at Cenvest. They provided us with an update on their performance for the financial year ended 30 April 2026. We speak to the chief financial officer of that business and get a sense of how it is that they fared. We also take a look at the latest announcement by PRASA, the Passenger Rail Agency of South Africa, that they would be looking to retrench approximately 600 employees despite having received some financing from the government of South Africa. We're going to take a look at that with the Africa Rail Industry Association and see what we make of it. Then we have a conversation taking a look at the latest implementation of the ARTO system that has been kicking off from the 1st of July. We speak to the Organization on Doing Tax Abuses Chief Executive Officer Wayne Duvenage to take a look at that and see if we can make sense of that implementation. Then we have a conversation with Santam's Leruo Malumo on their latest cashback program that they launched from a business perspective for consumers. We take a look at that and see where it is that they're aiming that particular product and service. And we wrap up the show, as we do every other Monday, with a personal finance conversation. We're going to be taking a look at how consumers are leveraging their credit positions to better sustain their livelihoods.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show, with a sense of market movements throughout the day. Joined on the line by Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, to take a look at markets and see what we make of them. Gary, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A firmer start to the week for the Rand. Not such a great start for equity markets locally and internationally, but the US markets seemingly having a bit of a rebound after being closed for those Independence Day celebrations. What did you make of today's moves?
Yeah, so I think the U.S. market's playing a little bit of catch-up. Many of the U.S. markets are closed on Friday, even though the 4th of July holiday was on Saturday. So, you know, it was fairly positive when we came to work this morning. The Nikkei was down a little bit and managed to close basically flat. But, we had some positivity across Asian markets. That didn't feed through into the JSE. So we had the all-share index down around a third of 1%. And that was led lower by the resource counters, more specifically our gold miners. So likes of Goldfields and Harmony, both talking up more than a 4% decline. On the upside, however, over in China, we saw a strong move higher in Tencent. That drove the process Naspers pair up over 1%. We had a pretty strong day on the banks as well, with First Rand, Nedbank, Standard Bank, and Absa all nicely positive, and that lifted the financial index 0.8%. Yeah, and the Rand looking very strong, very, very strong against the US dollar. We are currently trading at around 16.22. And I think that's maybe Middle Eastern talks progressing well. Oil price is still trading around $72 a barrel, so no big moves there. Of course, South Africa is an oil importer, so lower Brent crude oil prices improve our inflation outlook. That means, good things for the local currency. And I think also just the credibility of the Saab, our new inflation target in place. We spoke on the show last time about how we have high real yields in South Africa, which are very supportive of our currency. So looking good. Currency remains strong, and we'll take it.
Gary, speaking of those inflation and interest rate expectations, I want to take a look at where that puts us now. We know that, as you rightly mentioned, from a Saab perspective, they've been keeping a keen eye on our own inflation numbers, our latest inflation print, very concerning for them considering our revised target. But we also see the new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, coming in and saying in less than these words that he would not be allowed to be a puppet of perhaps the administration that is currently there, and he would continue to fight inflation, echoing the rhetoric left behind and the message left behind by Fed Chair Jerome Powell, in this case, I suppose, former Fed Chair Jerome Powell. What do we make of what this then does for rate expectations? We had priced in cuts at the start of the year, then the war happened, we priced in hikes. Where do we stand now?
It's a good question. So I think the exact phrasing he used is, "I won't be a human sock puppet," because there was a lot of fear that that of course he was an appointee of Donald Trump, and that he would be, I suppose there would be political pressure to lean on him and reduce interest rates even in the face of high inflation. And I think the first meeting made it very clear that he was focused on the one part of the Fed's mandate. So the Fed obviously has the dual mandate of full employment and price stability. And it was really a price stability, speech, first meeting at least. So, looking at the interest rate hike expectations currently, after the weakened non-farm payrolls numbers out last week, we're looking at about a 23% chance that there'll be no change in US interest rates from the December meeting. That was down to around 11% chance after the first FOMC meeting. So, the weak payroll numbers actually feeding into market expectations that, wait a minute, there might be a little bit of relief coming through. That said, I think the base case in the US at the moment is that we'll see 125 basis point hike, so 0.25%. Currently, Fed funds futures pricing that at about a 42% chance. Domestically, we're looking at probably one more rate hike from the South African Reserve Bank, maybe two, if you look at the forward rate agreement curve. So, I think interest rates still mildly higher, and yes, this is because inflation figures are printing a little bit higher. Yes, this is because of the Middle East, but I think it's also important to remember that we're looking at headline figures here, and that includes food and fuel, which are incredibly volatile. If we see that oil price remaining low, if we see that the soft commodity prices also come down reasonably, that headline number will fall very quickly. And maybe it's more relevant to be looking at the core inflation numbers at this stage. But we're looking at interest rate hikes, but not anywhere near as aggressively as when we had I suppose, a more chaotic situation in the Middle East.
Gary, let's stick in the US for a second and take a look at how markets have been performing, particularly equity markets. You mentioned that the US markets are playing a bit of catch up today. The Nasdaq is up more than 1%, the S&P up 0.5%. But the surprise here is year to date, the Russell 2000 has been outperforming the S&P 500.
When I looked at that, I was also a little bit surprised. So I think the story that we've seen, and certainly the narrative that we've seen, is big is beautiful in the US. And it's been all about the FANG stocks. Then it was the Magnificent Seven, and it's about these dominant global mega cap tech stocks that have really driven most of the performance. And I remember, even last year, I think on this show and in many presentations, we were just highlighting the disconnect between the equally weighted S&P 500 and the market cap weighted one, which everyone watches, and just showing how the market cap weighted index has really just taken off compared to the equally weighted index. We are starting to see that unwind, and I think that narrative has taken hold over probably the last month or so, as a lot of people look at these Mag 7 stocks. They look at they're delivering great earnings, don't get me wrong, but they're also starting to be a little bit more cognizant of the valuations and saying these stocks really are priced for perfection. And because of that, what we've seen is we've seen a moderation. This isn't a bubble popping and a total collapse, but it's a little bit of a deflation, a little bit of sector rotation. People starting to look for value in other segments of the market. We've seen the likes of consumer staples doing a lot better, and of course Russell 2000, which looks at the smaller cap sector of the US market. I mean, that 22% up year to date compared to the S&P 500 up 10%. You can see that there is a rotation, that people are cognizant, and certainly market participants are cognizant of these extended valuations, and they're starting to potentially just diversify a little bit.
Speaking of those rotations, it comes to mind the thoughts around one Michael Burry, and I want to take a look at that before I let you go, Gary, because he seems to be shorting Micron at the moment, and we're looking at markets where companies are becoming all the more attractive for investors, especially in this AI trade. I suppose if we are looking at moderation, sector rotation, and a bubble not bursting just yet, you probably need the patience of a Michael Burry if you are shorting anything.
So I think Michael Burry always makes headline because of, obviously, he was made famous, he was on asset management the movie The Big Short, and everyone watched that. And every time he places a position now, it's something that everyone follows. So yes, he has picked up a short position in Micron, which is obviously the memory maker, specifically focused on high bandwidth memory, which is absolutely critical in the AI supply chain. And I mean, he's been shorting above $1,000 a share. We'll see how it works out for him. I think the case around it. I mean, it's one of those things that you look at semiconductors. In general, they are a very, very cyclical industry, and they tend to have high fixed costs in their businesses. They have some spare capacity, but when that capacity is used up, they are wildly profitable. So if the demand is there, then they become wildly profitable. And we see the kind of 10-bagger returns that we've seen from Micron. I think Micron up at almost 600% year to date. So you see fantastic returns from stocks like this. And I think there's a lot of interest around these, specifically the memory producers, and specifically the high bandwidth memory, which is, because you only really have three producers, which is going to be Micron, Samsung, and SK Hynix. SK Hynix now coming to the NASDAQ for a dual listing this Friday. And that also, I think, maybe just rattling a few investors, saying, wait a minute, we've got some big listings coming up now. Why are these companies raising capital if they're so wildly profitable? SK Hynix, for example, saying that there's just so much demand for this high bandwidth memory, that this is a super cycle, that AI has really changed the game. This isn't the usual cyclicality they see from their customers, and really trying to expand their production. I mean, they say they're going to be raising, what is it, about $28 to $29 billion, and saying that this is really, they're going to be buying, more lithography, so extreme ultraviolet scanners from ASML, and they're just trying to increase their chip fabrication capacity. Now, obviously, in a cyclical industry, that should be ringing alarm bells, saying, wait a minute, we're building up this capacity. If there's a small pullback in demand here, suddenly you're going to see earnings drop off a cliff. And I think that is what Michael Burry is perhaps preempting. The problem is if this is a structural change to the market, if this data center build out continues, and the AI infrastructure spending continues from the hyperscalers, this can still go on for a couple of years. And in which case, I think Michael Burry is going to be very hurt.
Well, I suppose it's better late than, or better early than late in this case, if you are patient enough to wait it out, or if you have the balance sheet that Michael Burry has to be able to weather the holding charges across these particular decisions that you're making. We'll see how the markets shape up. We'll see where we go to from here. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Director and Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, Gary Boyson, joining us to take a look at markets and some of the sentiment behind them.
Did you know that South Africa has one of the highest crypto adoption rates in the world? Fact. With that comes massive innovation and new opportunities. Stablecoins are the new buzzword in the industry. These are crypto versions of the Rand, the Euro, and the US dollar. But what's coming is even more exciting. Being able to borrow against your crypto and buying tokenized real-world assets such as stocks, wine, football teams, and real estate. Join me, Kieran Ryan, on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast each week to stay on top of what's happening in the fascinating world of crypto.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
The wonderful thing about the Johannesburg Stock Exchange is that it has a multitude of companies that do exceptionally well, even if those companies aren't always heard of. Today, we're going to be taking a look at one such company called Senvest. Many of you might not know the company. That is because it is not listed on the JSE's main board. However, it is still a listed entity in the over-the-counter market, and they recently released their results for their financial year ended 30 April 2026. We're going to be taking a look at these numbers in a bit more detail with the company's chief financial officer, Derek Engelbracht, who joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Derek, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. A strong increase in overall profits after tax from a business perspective, growth across most metrics, normalized earnings per share growing, return on opening equity increasing by 2.6%, and the cash conversion rate of the business holding steady, coming down ever so slightly. How did you and the management team reflect on the year that was?
For the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon. The results was driven by strong performance across almost all of our businesses, particularly in our input supply, with specific reference to our equipment business, and then in our market access business. each business plays an important role, but our real strength came from working together to create more value. It also reflects the benefit of Senvest's diversified business model. So with a little bit of disciplined capital allocation, portfolio optimization, it all contributed to a profit after tax increasing by 25% to 808 million rand.
Derek, let's take a look at that diversification from an operations standpoint. The business largely focused in the agriculture space, but across many areas of the agriculture space, from grain to seed and fertilizer to fuel to financing and even wealth planning around that from a business perspective. Take us through what that diversification looks like from a portfolio performance. Perspective.
Our market access business is at the heart of our grain business, and it essentially helps producers to move grain from the farm to the market. The second segment that I refer to is input supply, and that helps producers with all of the products, equipment, and services they need to keep their farms running. Our third segment is our financial services business. That is essentially where we fund the big crop, all of the input costs, and lastly, our processing, conditioning, and markets cluster, which creates more value from agricultural products through specialized processing activities and participation in downstream markets.
Derek, let's take a look at the market and the operating environment that you find yourselves in. I mean, from an agricultural standpoint, there's been a lot that has affected the agricultural landscape locally and internationally. Everything from the escalating tensions in the Middle East to having to deal with tariff impositions by the United States, specifically to the agricultural sector, perhaps more so than others. How did you fare against some of these conditions that understandably had nothing to do with your business?
Yeah, well, for the first comment is probably worth making on the weather. So producers delivered one of the largest crops on record, but the late rainfall resulted in unusually high levels of lower grade grain. And that created a challenge for both producers as well as grain handlers such as ourselves. Our investment in color sorting technology allowed us to upgrade lower grade maize into higher marketable grain, whilst our new drying infrastructure enabled our producers to harvest earlier and deliver higher moisture grain safely to the silos. On the tariff side, our business, particularly our export raisin business, was affected by tariffs imposed by the US. And you are quite right that we look forward to a higher input cost into the next season harvests, when the price of diesel not only impacted on current year harvesting costs, but also the shortage of fertilizer, we think will impact negatively on the margins of some of our producers in the new year.
Derek, the business also took on quite a bit of new debt in this particular financial year. I see the debt to GDP ratio increasing from about 70% to just over 94%. From a business perspective, take us through what is planned there strategically in terms of how that's going to be deployed. Understandably, we're still going through different cycles, whether we're looking at weather cycles like El Nino impacting the business, as you alluded to, some of the weather challenges. The business going forward from a strategic perspective, how are you looking to deploy that additional debt to perhaps enhance the bottom line?
Thanks, Jimmy. I think maybe just to comment on the historical ratio, our commodity financing, which essentially is raised against much higher volumes of grain in our silos, was predominantly the reason for the increase in some of the debt to equity ratios that you have quoted. In the new financial year, we plan to work together very strongly with our producers and the communities in which we operate to also ensure that there's a sustainable long-term wealth created in the agri value chain.
Derek, before I let you go, can we take a look at the financial services side of the business? I mean, understandably, that forms quite an interesting part of what it is you're able to offer the agricultural landscape, particularly from a producer perspective. You're able to lend yourself from services and an advisory perspective, much to the benefit of the agricultural sector. How is that business picking up? And are you seeing great demand from your customers with respect to that unit?
We like to think of that segment in two ways. The first one helps producers to grow. So our financing business delivered a strong performance during the year, continuing to support producers despite a more challenging environment. The business grew its financing portfolio and helped producers to fund their farming operations. This growth was achieved even though lower interest rates reduced earnings from the financing book. Despite these challenges, our business maintained strong credit discipline and worked closely with clients and kept credit quality stable. Our second business, which is protecting what matters, that is our advisory and insurance book, their superpower is really simple. They protect what matters so that our clients can focus on looking after the harvest. CertiSure helps farmers, families, and businesses protect what matters most.
Helping farmers and families protect what matters most to them and ensuring that agricultural producers in South Africa have a way to access markets. The team at Cenvest reporting their financial year results for the year ended 30 April 2026. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Derek Engelbracht, Chief Financial Officer at Cenvest, joining us to take a look at their performance over the last year.
I'm Nobukhanya Mdambo, the host of MoneyWeb's small business podcast, Mzansi Business, built around the real voices of South African entrepreneurs. This is where the conversation becomes real, where business owners share what it actually takes to build, not just succeed, but survive. We shine the spotlight on local businesses, their challenges, growth, and what it takes to succeed. Each episode becomes a moment of truth, a decision point, a lesson, a turning point in a real business journey.
The podcast delivers deep, honest conversations with entrepreneurs navigating real decisions. This is where trust is built.
Money, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Earlier this year, when the budget speech was tabled before Parliament and tabled to South Africa by the Minister of Finance, it was announced that the team at PRASA, the Passenger Rails Agency of South Africa, would be receiving just shy of 6 billion rands in funding to advance their rail reform efforts. Just recently, the staff members at PRASA have received documents from their employer notifying them that PRASA would be embarking on retrenchment processes as it faces severe financial and operational constraints. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the Chief Executive Officer of the Africa Rail Industry Association, Msela Nhlapo. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Msela Nhlapo, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Were you surprised by the announcement from PRASA that they would be looking to retrench almost 600 employees?
Good evening. Yes, it did catch me by surprise. As an industry body, our members rely on their employees to manufacture. Although it's not clear as it stands at the moment at what level the retrenchment will be undertaken. It's unfortunate that the rail reform that we have worked so hard for, that we had pursued the rail reform on the basis that it will create jobs, and we did not anticipate that it will result in this. And perhaps the question that needs to be asked is rather that government together with PRASA, what has been done in terms of the initial policy in terms of the socioeconomic impact analysis, it would have done at least viewed that there's a potential job losses and find ways to prevent the job losses. And I think a retrenchment in this day and age is something that should concern each and every one of us. A policy, a reform, it's meant to create jobs and not to further deepen the unemployment in the country.
Msela, can we take a look at the reasons behind PRASA suggesting this? They suggest that they are experiencing financial constraints. And if we look back at their overall program, the program to overhaul the entity from as far back as 2022, they had looked to re-energize and overhaul the business of the 7.5 billion rand that they had been allocated from that far back. They had about 3.48 billion that they'd spent by the end of of March of last year. This despite the $5.8 billion that was announced at this year's budget speech that would be allocated to them. How do we reconcile the financial injections from a stakeholder and a shareholder in the form of the government with the financial constraints that PRASA is saying that they're having?
I think it's important to, history plays a very critical role when we have to do this type of analysis. There was a time when PRASA was running and it had recorded passengers that were using its system. And then something happened. And it was that contracts were cancelled because of them being maybe improperly awarded to certain companies. But we must, as a society, remain truthful to the issues around corporate governance. Corporate governance and the fiduciary responsibilities that different board members at PRASA had. The type of reform, the type of work that has been done at PRASA is precisely to correct what certain decisions that was taken at a particular time meant to PRASA. So the damage that you see at PRASA that was trying to be fixed, it was caused by a decision made by individuals at a particular time. So those individuals must be held accountable. It was their fiduciary duty to make sure that whatever decisions that they take was in line with the Companies Act. And if they are found to be wanting, they need to account to that. So the current constraint, the financial constraint, is because money has been going to fix the infrastructure. The infrastructure that was left naked because security contracts were cancelled. We are not saying that security contracts were not supposed to be cancelled, but it was supposed to be done so responsibly. You can't make decisions as a PRASA and a PRASA board for the sake of being right and not make sure that the decision that you make is in the best interest of the organization that you are leading. So the workers are actually victims of decisions made then, and that truth needs to be told. And it also places a burden for all leaders, that when we lead society, particularly state-owned entities, that we need to act responsibly. There is no way that this country, with so many issues around state-owned entities, that board members have never been held accountable for the decisions that they have taken and the mess that we find ourselves now that we are fixing. And I think that when we review and analyze where PRASA is today with retrenchment, we need to question where we come from and that people must be held accountable.
Marcella, before I let you go, the task team currently looking at this particular matter is expected to deliver a progress report to the Minister of Transport, Barbara Creasy, soon around this particular issue and where it is, or some of their recommendations around how it is that we move this forward. If we are to extrapolate and perhaps look into the future that you and I cannot predict, what would the impact be if there are no alternatives found to this retrenchment that's being proposed here, other than the obvious, the 600 workers that are going to be impacted, their livelihoods, their families, but to the overall stability of PRASA and this turnaround plan?
Well, I believe that the right decisions would be made, and because when we look at these policies, we always use the sustainable development goals as a true measure whether we are progressing as a nation or not. And the golden principle stands. It says, leave no one behind. You can't progress as a society with rail reform and increasing investment, whereas we are then throwing the people that built this organization to the streets and leaving them to fend for themselves. That's not what a responsible government that I know and I trust that the minister with the stakeholders that are included in the task team will find a middle ground. And that middle ground does not stop at BRASA. It continues to the entire sector. When a policy does not prioritize localization, retrenchments will follow. So, and maybe this retrenchment from PRASA, it must not be only for PRASA, but retrenchments will follow when this country does not manufacture, when this country does not stick to its own policy, particularly Chapter 6 of the National Rail Policy about reindustrialization, about what the president has given us as a task that we must reindustrialize. How do you then reindustrialize and retrench and leave people behind and add to the pain that most South Africans are feeling?
Localization certainly at the center of how it is that we get out of these sorts of situations. We will see what the report that is delivered by the task team suggests we should do around avoiding these retrenchments. Again, hopefully they can be avoided at all costs. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer of Africa Rail Industry Association, Ms. Ellen Tlapo, joining us to share her thoughts on the announcement by the Passenger Rails Agency of South Africa that they would be looking to potentially retrench 600 employees despite the 5.8 billion rand they received from the government.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, alongside the announcement that we got from PRASA, we also know that effective from 1 July 2026, just last week, we got the implementation of the auto system. This has been something that has been in the works and delayed on several occasions. We finally have the Administrative Adjunction of Road Traffic Offences Act coming into effect, the updated version of that. We're going to be taking a look at this and potentially taking a look at how the rollout could affect consumers. I'm joined on the line by Chief Executive Officer of the organisation Undoing Tax Abuse, Wayne Duvenage, to take a look at this, see what to make of it. Wayne, lovely having you on our show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. The rollout seemingly something that was on the cards, off the cards. You and I caught up about it when it was on the cards for December. Then it came off the table. We finally see some of it coming to market in various shapes and forms. What do you make of how it's been implemented?
Yeah, look, it's very problematic. A number of municipalities are still using the wrong forms. They don't have everything in place. The system is, we believe, not being stress tested, so there are going to be problems. But yes, look, let's start at the beginning very briefly. This is a process that's been on and off for actually 20 years. And we think they're chasing a launch date deadline as opposed to a readiness deadline or readiness capacity issue. So it is seriously problematic. The people aren't aware. The regulations were put out. There was no time given for any public commentary, which they have to do. And the law is also quite clear. The appeals tribunal needs to be in place when they launch, and it's not, even though the demerit point system has not been launched yet. So lots of problems, and we still think this is going to face some legal challenges, and we think it's going to face more than that, administrative challenges, which makes it unworkable. So it's in a very precarious position at the moment.
Wayne, you mentioned readiness versus launch in terms of implementation, and I want to get your thoughts on perhaps what that does to taking us forward. Are we not saying we're going one step forward and potentially two steps back because we might have to correct some of the things that we rushed to implement if those legal challenges do go that way?
Yeah, you know, and we know that SALGO is challenging it legally. They didn't get the urgency, but that doesn't mean to say the merits of their case are not correct. We've already seen some municipalities like the City of Cape Town and the DA-run municipalities who control their own revenue and are very doing a good job of it are saying we're not prepared to give up half our revenue to RTA. And they're entitled to, by the way, say that. This is something we raised right in the beginning on our constitutional court challenge where the constitutional court, we believe, got it wrong. But we said, okay, fine, let it play out. And exactly what we called for is happening. So some municipalities are saying, sorry, we'll upload the information for your point demerit system when that comes. But for now, we are not handing over our collection process to RTAA. We're doing it well. We're in control of it. We have our executive authorities in that regard to do so, and we will not be forced to comply or fit in with your system. So again, all of these things are starting to happen. They are not ready. 62 municipalities out of 247 is in first phase, and we're already seeing problems. And again, we've said to the minister, we've said to RTIA right in the beginning, we have so many issues with this. We're not opposed to, you know, good administration and systems, but if they can't work, if they're unenforceable, if they can't be implemented, don't rush ahead. Get it right, get it fixed, and then implement, because you will lose the public, you'll lose trust, and your government just doesn't need this loss and trust from the public. And then these things collapse again. Same thing with e-tolls. It's a, just a rehashing of this attitude that if we just legislate something, it'll fall into place.
Wayne, speaking of that e-toll, I mean, surely the e-toll saga taught us important lessons around how costly this becomes for South Africans, because at the end of the day, the taxpayer foots the bill for anything that the government needs to pay for. If we're looking at this implementation, again, as you said, nobody's going against the implementation of Arto. It is merely around whether or not the rushed aspects of it have all been considered, or all the aspects have been considered ahead of rushing the implementation. How do we avoid making those same mistakes? How do we avoid learning from the past if this is the viewpoint to say, let's promulgate and figure it out later?
You know what's sad, Jimmy, is that you're quite right. The government should be learning from its mistakes, but it doesn't. For some strange reason, it forgets it. It says basically to itself, look, we're in charge, we know what we're doing, that's a totally different matter, but it's very similar. They haven't done public consultation properly, they haven't done administration, all the ducks in a row, and compliance processes properly. So unfortunately, and it's going to suffer the same fate. And again, you know, government thinks that this is their money. It's our money that they're spending. And they need to be cognizant of civil society's viewpoints. When we did an engagement, by the way, with stakeholders, it wasn't just us and a few people. We engaged with fleet owners, with big businesses. We even had the Metro Police at a summit that we had on this discussion. They agreed with us there are challenges, and it wasn't ready. This was some time ago. We invited the RTIA and RTMC. Initially, they agreed to come the day before they pulled out. This is the type of attitude, you know, head in the sand, ostrich mentality. No, we don't need any feedback from civil society. Well, then don't, you know, but then suffer the consequences of the system failing, and then ask yourself, why do you not have the backing of society? And it's precisely this arrogant approach that they take.
Speaking of consequences, Wayne, I want to take a look at the potential impact that this implementation would have on consumers as it currently stands. We know that in some areas like Johannesburg and Pretoria, Arto's effectively been in effect in some way, shape or form for a very long time. I want to take a look at the potential impact of going into this with half measures and what that opens the consumers up for in terms of what they might be liable for, but also what protections they might have if they are wronged, and wronged because of something that was just not implemented properly.
Yeah, look, this is where it's going to get messy, and a lot of anxiety starts to rise, and the public aren't sure how to deal with things. And this is where RTIA have to be very, very clear on their website. For instance, if you have an inquiry, or if you want to redirect this fine, or it's not yours because it's a totally different vehicle in another part of the country, someone's cloned your number plate, they have to have all of those processes in place. And we will do our best, as are others, to enlighten and empower the citizens with knowledge of their rights on this. And that's what's going to happen. A scheme will collapse under its own weight. And they're going to have to go back to the drawing board. But here's, for instance, one thing that you need to know as a family owner, and certainly in businesses, and that is a lot of businesses say, look, when we get the fine, we pay it, and then we deal with the individual in our company who transgressed. Let's say it's you're a driver in a fleet, in a company that's got a fleet of vehicles. Well, you can't do that anymore as a business. And myself, you know, so for instance, if you have bought your daughter a vehicle and these cars are on your name, if you don't redirect those fines to the person who has transgressed, you pick up You might pay the fine, but there's points, demerit points that come to you as the vehicle owner. So you need to now not just say, okay, pay the fine. You need to redirect in the system that fine to the actual driver so that they pick up the point, the demerit points on their license and not you. And this applies to businesses. And then businesses, if they don't do that, they will rack up the points and they will be blocked from licensing their vehicles on their fleets across the country. These are the practicalities that people aren't aware of yet. And that now that only kicks in when the demerit point system kicks in, by the way, but you've got to get into the habit of doing that now rather than wait for the last moment to do so.
Wayne, do we have any indication on when the full system would kick into effect with the demerit system or structure?
Look, you have to have all municipalities on board before you can put that in. They've got the first 62 on board where they say they have. We don't believe they have. They're a long way off from getting all of them. Well, I've got a feeling that this is not going to get to 257 all municipalities on board before they realize how serious the problems are. I don't think that the demerit point system is going to be in place for the next 2 years minimum.
Well, until then, consumers are going to be caught in a weird sort of limbo, not understanding what parts of the auto legislation apply, what parts do not, and most importantly, how it is that we navigate that. We'll see how this shapes up. We'll keep an eye on it and bring you all of the latest from that, of course. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. Organization Undoing Tax Abuse's Chief Executive Officer Wayne Duvenage joining us to take a look at the implementation and rollout of auto and what we make of it.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Now, of course, at this stage in the year, we're all looking to find better ways to optimize our savings and our pockets. And alongside that, that extends all the way through to things like insurance. To this effect, the team at Santam have put together a cashback program, looked at rewarding responsible risk management. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the head of product strategy, development and governance at Santam, Lerua Malumo. He joins me on the line now to see what to make of this. Lerua, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Tell us about this cashback program that Santam has in effect. How did it come about from an insurance perspective, and what does it even look like for an insurance business to offer this?
Hi, Jimmy. Thanks for having me. So at its core, insurance really, it's about helping clients manage their risk responsibly. Our cashback was designed to recognize and reward customers who consistently demonstrate low risk behavior. So really what that looks like is maintaining your cover, keeping premiums up to date and remaining claim-free over time. In essence, we're turning responsible behavior into a measurable financial reward.
Lerua, what does responsible behavior look like in this case? How does one behave responsibly where it relates to insurance?
So where it comes to insurance, really it's about being proactive. And this is something we picked up just from our engagement with clients, that they're saying it's one thing for my insurer really to be there when things go wrong and to pay out, and that's great. But what I'm looking for is a part in managing my assets over time. So responsible behavior really is about being proactive, and it's about those moments before something goes wrong, those moments in between claims, and being a partner at that time. What we're talking about in terms of the cashback program is initially a three-year period, which really establishes the foundation and the sustainability of the program and says if you remain claim-free for 3 years, you will receive a portion of your premiums back at the end of that cycle. It then transitions into an annual reward cycle, meaning that after the 3 years, you actually get a cash back every year that you remain claim-free from that point onwards.
Lerua, you mentioned claim-free, and I suppose the immediate question that comes up in the minds of South Africans is, but I don't intend to claim from insurance when I take the insurance policy. Insurance is there as a safeguard for those unforeseen events. Now, does this not seem a bit like discouraging from consumers utilizing their insurance?
That's a very good point. And the intent obviously is not to discourage legitimate claims. That is precisely why we exist. And for that reason, we've looked at the categories of claims which would reset your cashback clock, and looked at those that we could take out simply to make sure that we're actually encouraging the right kind of behavior. So for example, you're driving along and a stone jumps up, knocks your windscreen. If it is chipped and you come in and get that sorted before it splinters and has to be entirely replaced, that claim for a chipped windscreen will not cause you to forfeit your cashback. Similarly, with geyser maintenance, it is, you know, it's an awful thing for your geyser to burst and there's consequential damage to your contents, etc. But if you stay on top of what's happening with your geyser and submit a claim just for the maintenance of it, which is maybe replacing an element, that claim will not trigger a reset of your cashback. So really, it's about saying we know that life happens and in those moments we'll be there. But there, if there are things that can be done, again, proactively to mitigate against, you know, the likelihood of something happening in future, that is also something we want to reward.
Leroy, let's take a look at the cashback component of this in a bit more detail. You touched on the fact that initially there'd be a three-year period, and thereafter it would then be structured differently from an annual basis perspective. From a cashback perspective, how is Santam intending to provide that cashback to consumers? I know from different kinds of rewards programs, some might say they'll give you a year's off of the premiums instead of the cash back directly into your account. Does this make a difference from a Santam perspective, or is it more around ensuring that the customers see the benefit rather than how it is that they receive it?
Right. So cash has come through as the by far the preferred mechanism of being rewarded. But definitely there is appetite for being rewarded in other ways. So we really do see this cashback as the beginning of a journey in terms of building out what this relationship looks like. So to start off with, it is going to be literal cash back in your account. And over time, we're going to tie that into broader group value propositions, which would allow for clients to have options. It's definitely not a case of one or the other. So as those additional value propositions roll out, clients won't lose their autonomy or choice to say, it's all well and good, but can I just have cash in my account? We'll always make sure that that is available to them.
And couldn't we all use an extra little bit of cash? The team at Santam launching their cashback reward program that looks to reward responsible behavior on the part of their customers. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Head of Product Strategy Development and Governance at Santam, Leroy Malumo, joining us to take a look at their new cashback program.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It is personal finance time on a Monday, and we're going to be taking a look at some of the affordability pressures consumers have been under and how it is that they have been navigating the credit landscape. I'm joined on the line by the Director of Research and Consulting at TransUnion South Africa, Aisha Hattier, to take a look at this and see what we make of it. Aisha, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Your latest Industry Insights report suggests that consumers have been faring with a lot of pressure that they've had to deal with, especially where it relates to affordability. How have consumers been navigating the current economic challenges?
So we are seeing some steady and disciplined growth in parts of the market. You know, in terms of credit, we do see what we call a two-speed credit economy emerging. So your traditional banking, your banking personal loans, your home loans, your vehicle finance, they do seem to be growing quite disciplined and uniformly. While we are seeing faster growth in the non-bank lending space, so the demand for that shorter-term liquidity solutions. So overall, we're seeing that there's not necessarily a decline in demand for credit, but we are seeing that there's changing in consumer needs and how also the different lenders are responding to those needs.
Aisha, what are some of the biggest concerns for consumers at the moment? I can imagine things like payment distress issues might be coming up with the tough economic environment we find ourselves in, maybe perhaps an increase in loans as a result of some other factors. What are we seeing from some consumer behavior around how they're navigating this time?
Yes, we are seeing consumers trying to leverage off those shorter-term credit products to manage that day-to-day liquidity and the affordability needs. And so, again, that demand for credit is not moving away. I think it's very important at this stage for consumers to understand how these small changes happening around them in terms of interest rates and inflation actually impacts their wallet. So if you take an example, you know, with the 25 basis point rate that went up, looking at it roughly at about 280 Rand a month on an average 1 million Rand home and an average 400,000 Rand car. And so again, on the inverse of that, you need to think about we've just had a fuel reduction, and that could improve cash flow by 417 a month. So it's really for consumers to understand what is happening in the market and what is that levers in their wallet that they can pull as these changes happen. I think the biggest thing for consumers is that ability to absorb shocks. So when things go up, how much leeway do they have in their wallet to cater for that shock?
Aisha, how do consumers build that leeway up? I mean, we've talked about things like having emergency funds in place, setting aside some finances, but for many consumers that don't have that luxury and that option, that might not even be a conversation that can be had. So how then do consumers look at the current climate, look at the already stretched wallets, and start to build in those buffers? What sorts of habits and insights can consumers use here?
It's very tricky, Jim, and I would hate to generalize because it's really a very personal thing for consumers at an individual level. And so the important part is for each consumer to actually understand their wallet and understand where their key expenses are, where their priorities are, and also unpack for their own personal views, you know, what are the priorities and what are some of the sort of discretionary spend and where the cutbacks. And so it really takes, you know, a sit back and a sit down from these consumers in terms of drawing up a budget, understanding the expenses. And to your point, some of them are at that limit, are at that stretch, so has very little leeway. And eventually something's got to give and something has to sort of sacrifice. And so understanding that and being aware of it is quite important from a consumer at this point, because anything can happen. I mean, we've gone through a tremendous volatile 6 years with, you know, with the interest rates and the petrol going up and down. And then there's a knock-on effect on inflation, on your food basket, on your groceries. And so again, understanding, if I look at my food basket, if I look at my grocery budget, where are the specific things I can cut down? And those little amounts all accumulate. So understanding that is important.
Aisha, it's also important to understand where consumers are going wrong so that we can avoid these areas. Are there any standout areas where consumers are needing to improve behaviors, or perhaps areas where you want to almost stay away from because of how dangerous and volatile they might be to the consumer pocket?
Yes, so the one thing that we need to avoid is overextension. And so again, credit is meant to be a tool for leveraging and leveraging your shorter-term liquidity solutions when it comes to the short-term products, but also to help you from a more structured perspective when it comes to the bigger assets. And so again, the important part is understanding your affordability, and lenders play a big role in terms of assessing that affordability in terms of responsible access to credit as these cost pressures evolve. So again, it's for consumers to understand, where is that gap in my budget? How can I use credit to leverage and support that? But also making sure that the installments remain affordable and that you're keeping up with those installments as well.
Aisha, what about the consumers that had unexpected life events happen? I mean, these happen all the time. You touched on the COVID pandemic having an impact on consumers. For many consumers, sudden retrenchments coming up mean that even if affordability was in the picture beforehand, it suddenly isn't the same situation. How do they navigate the landscape and understand that they might have means or options to ease some of their burdens?
Yeah, and again, we don't want to make an assumption that it's easy for people to have these nest eggs. And we generally say that, again, the ability for consumers to, for lack of a better word, survive these incidents is that ability to absorb shock. So what do they have to absorb the shock? Do they have a gap in their wallet? Do they have savings? Can they leverage off savings from the two-pot system? And again, these are all hypothetical, depending on individual situations. And so again, it's understanding what do they have? What are the tools they have in their toolbox in terms of being able to absorb the shock and overcome it? In their scenario, it might be that they turn to credit, but again, understanding how do we get credit responsibly and how do we use credit responsibly and making sure that the necessary affordability is done and that the installments is reasonable for the individual's wallet.
Aisha, one of the interesting aspects of South African consumers is their need for vehicles, whether we're talking new vehicles, whether we're talking secondhand vehicles, and a lot of the conversations around vehicles, because of the nature of that asset, involve financing. How are we seeing consumers approaching their vehicle financing needs at this time?
So you saw that the vehicle financing has grown by 11.6% year on year, and also the repayment performance has improved year on year in the vehicle finance space. And so this space does tend to behave differently, you know, than our traditional credit products, just because mobility is so closely linked to economic participations. So for many South Africans, having access to a vehicle supports employment, income generation, and their daily productivity, which does make, you know, the vehicle repayments a high priority. And we're seeing that in the stats with the delinquency numbers coming down. We're also seeing that the vehicle pricing for new vehicles is becoming more attractive as more imports are coming into the country. And so it's continuing to support the demand for new cars, even though affordability pressures persist in other wallets.
Everybody does have a unique set of circumstances and a unique way of navigating those circumstances. And this is why this particular conversation was not financial advice, but you can certainly seek out the help of a financial advisor if that is something that you are in need of. We'll have to leave this conversation on that note for now. Aisha Hatia joining us from TransUnion to take a look at their latest insights report around consumer spending behavior where it relates to credit. It's just gone 7 o'clock. Chanduko Ligege and the SAFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. From my side, good night.